Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Robin Buller, your host. Today we will be talking about a new edited volume, World War I and the Jews, Conflict and Transformation in Europe, the Middle East, and America, a fantastic new collection of important essays from top scholars that cover an array of understudied topics related to the Jews and the First World War. Here with me today to talk about the book are its editors, Professor Marsha Rosenblit, the Harvey M. Meyerhoff Professor of Modern Jewish History at the University of Maryland, and Professor Jonathan Karp, who is Associate Professor of Judaic Studies and History at Binghamton University at the State University of New York. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
It's nice to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. I know we've tried to do this a few times, and now we'll finally be able to have our interview. Very excited. Before we discuss the book, I wonder if you could each tell the listeners a little bit about yourselves.
Well, I'll take the prerogative of going first. I teach, as you said, I teach Jewish history at the University of Maryland. I have been here for 40 years, so I feel like an old timer in many ways. But in any case, I'm a specialist on the Jews of Central Europe, in particular the Habsburg monarchy, Austria-Hungary in the late 19th and early 20th century, as well as its successor states in the 1920s and 30s. So places like Austria and Czechoslovakia and so forth. I've written about the Jews of Vienna in the late 19th century. I've written a book on the Jews of Habsburg Austria during World War I. And I've written a lot of articles on various aspects of Jewish life, including things like Jewish marriage and courtship patterns in 1920s Vienna, or Jewish schools in Moravia, and so forth. So I'm a specialist on the Jews of Central Europe, and World War I is one of my special interests.
And I am a historian with a fairly wide range or eclectic range of interests. Probably the unifying feature is an interest in Jewish economic life in the early modern and modern periods in Europe and in 20th century U.S. I've written a book about perceptions and debates around Jews' emancipation in Europe from 1648 to 1848, and how their economic roles featured in those debates. And I'm working on a study of Black Jewish economic and cultural relations in the modern U.S. I've edited a number of volumes or co-edited volumes, not including World War I and the Jews, or in addition to World War I and the Jews, a volume on Philo-Semitism in history. Philo-Semitism being, if not the opposite, then a kind of alternative or counterpart to anti-Semitism, an edited volume on Jews and the arts in the modern period, and the Cambridge history of Judaism in the early modern period. I also, in relevance to, I think, this project was for 3 years, from 2010 to 2013, the executive director of the American Jewish Historical Society, which is part of the Center for Jewish History in New York City. And that features largely in our, or centrally in this project.
And so considering these, you know, overlapping but divergent backgrounds, what brought you two to write about Jews in the First World War? What inspired this project?
Jonathan, why don't you start and I'll jump in at some point.
I was going to say, Marcia has long been writing about Jews in World War One. For me, it was an interest that was sparked by a colleague of mine at Binghamton, Alan Arkish, who is the co-editor of the Jewish Review of Books, who expressed to me the notion that a panoramic history of Jews in World War One has never been done, and it would be a great project. And that stuck in my mind when I went to New York City and was at the Center for Jewish History. One of my responsibilities was to supervise several postdocs who were working on disparate subjects, and to write a proposal for a conference featuring their research. And I was searching for a unifying theme to bring together what they were working on. And I realized that actually, without them recognizing necessarily this themselves, they all had in common that their work overlapped with or touched upon the topic of World War One and the Jews. So I wrote the proposal. It was successful. We had a great panel at the Association of Jewish Studies Conference. And Judith Siegel, who was the director of programming at the Center for Jewish History, a wonderful person to whom we dedicate the volume, actually, approached me and said, you know, that was such a successful proposal and panel. It strikes me that maybe we could do a conference here on World War One and the Jews. Of course, it was the centennial of the war.
The beginning of the war.
The beginning of the war. That's right. So We gathered a number of scholars, including David Engel and Hasia Diner, Rebecca Kobrin, Gennady Estrich, and soon brought in Marcia, who is one of the leading experts on the topic, and we started to plan the conference out of which this book, this volume, emerged.
I should say that it was a real pleasure to work with this organizing committee. I was brought in a little bit late to the process because all of the original people were in New York and I live near Washington. But David Engel of NYU had some really interesting ideas how to structure the conference, and the book is structured the same way. Our edited volume is structured the same way. It was his idea, and we went with it to, have senior scholars give general talks about the impact of the war on Jewish life or on different aspects of Jewish life, all around the world, or at least in the areas of our specialization, and then to have more junior scholars who were in the archives doing nitty-gritty research on Jewish communities in these various areas that were affected by the war, primarily Europe and the Middle East and the United States, or North America, but everyone in the North America part was the United States, to give more in-depth, papers on one or another aspect of the war. And that worked really well at the conference, and it really worked very well in our volume, we thought. And then after the conference, which was a very well-attended conference at the center, I would say there, several hundred people attended, it was Judith's idea, Judith Siegel, the same person that Jonathan just mentioned, who urged us to publish it because the papers were really good and really interesting. And Jonathan and I took on the task of editing it. And it was really, I must say, a pleasure both to work with Jonathan and all of the authors of these essays in producing a volume that really addressed a lot of very important issues in the war that had not really been addressed before.
And let me just pick up on that last point. And thank you, Marcia. It was, of course, an enormous pleasure and honor to work with you. But the last point is really crucial, I think, for your listeners, Robin, and that is that despite the assumption that World War I is a major event in modern history as it is and universally recognized as such, there really was relatively little scholarly literature on the topic of World War I and the Jews. And I'll just qualify that a little, and maybe we'll talk about it more in greater depth if you'd like to. But while there have been any number of studies on the Jews of an individual country or nation or region and World War I, there really were few, if any, studies that tried to take in the bigger picture. We wanted to address that huge gap, especially given the timing. So I think fulfills or begins to fill a great need and a great gap in the scholarship, and that reflects a kind of consciousness or lack of consciousness about the importance, the overall importance globally of World War I and the Jews.
And I'm going to just piggyback on that point to say that I think that one of the reasons that World War I as an event has not attracted, before our volume, has not attracted the attention of scholars in a global sort of way is because the transformations that the war engendered in Jewish life in Europe, in the Middle East, and so forth were eclipsed by even greater transformations after World War II. Mm-hmm. And so the Holocaust loomed so large that even scholars that were not scholars of the Holocaust itself kind of just ignored World War I. They dealt with the pre-war period, and then they dealt with the interwar period without paying attention, and of course the Holocaust, without paying attention to the impact of World War I itself on the transformation of Jewish life. And so we hope that our volume, our conference first, and then our volume, really addresses that issue.
Yeah, and let's stick with this topic of historiography for a minute. There is, of course, this enormous gap in World War I literature on World War I and the Jews, but also in Jewish history on the topic of World War I. But among the sort of limited studies that do address it, how has the history of World War I and the Jews been commonly understood and presented, you know, up until now, before your volume?
Well, I think that most of the studies, as Jonathan said, they're mostly country focused, right? The Jews in Germany, say, or the Jews in some other country, or my book, which is about the Jews in Habsburg Austria. The focus was on the country. And so therefore, the focus of the scholarship or excellent literature, I mean, the books that have been written are very good.
Absolutely.
And I'm not singing my own praises. I mean, they're very good studies. They were focused on such issues as patriotism, the extent to which Jews did their patriotic duty and what that meant. That was an important focus of the literature. And that's an important issue, and it's in our volume as well. I mean, that is important. How do the Jews feel about their service in the war? And obviously some Jewish communities felt more positive about their service and their patriotism than others, right? The Jews in Russia were a little less keen about fighting for the Tsar than the Jews, say, in Germany were about fighting for the Kaiser,
right?
Or the Jews in England for fighting for the king. So one focus has been patriotism. A second focus has been the rise of virulent anti-Semitism in many European countries at the end of the war. For example, in Germany or Austria-Hungary, there was as there were food shortages and as the war just dragged on and people were just dying for no apparent reason, a lot of people blamed the Jews, and there was a lot of very nasty anti-Semitism, which in some cases led to physical violence. Not in Germany or Austria itself, but certainly in Eastern Europe, in Russian Empire at the end of the war, but even in parts of Austria-Hungary that went into interwar Poland, there were pogroms against the Jews at the end of the war, because the Jews were blamed for the food shortages, for the horrors of the war, and for the nationalist squabbles of the Jews. So anti-Semitism was an important issue. And I guess the third issue was the place of the Jews in the nationalist debates. That is, World War I, as you know, unleashed the desire of many peoples of East Central Europe and Eastern Europe were their own countries, right? The Poles wanted an independent Poland. The Czechs wanted an independent, well, ultimately Czechoslovakia, but originally Czechia, you know. And what was the place of the Jews in that? And you know, were the Jews Poles? Were the Jews Czechs? You know, so that issue has been studied, and especially its connection to anti-Semitism. But those were the only issues, and not some of the larger issues that we hope to deal with in our book, although we do deal with those issues in our book for sure.
I'll just add that a point that has already been made, just to elaborate a little bit. I think to the extent that World War I was conceptualized more broadly than in regard to individual countries and locales, it tended to be seen as setting the stage or helping to set the stage for World War II and for the Holocaust. And I think it's a really interesting historiographical and philosophical issue, because there's a lot of truth to that, as Marcia's remarks just alluded to. But on the other hand, it's very hard to look at an event purely from the vantage point of subsequent events, an even larger or more momentous event that follows, you know, some decades later. And the challenge here, I think, in looking at World War I and the Jews is in part, not entirely, that would be foolish, but in part to try to not forget, but block out awareness of what comes later, simply to be able to focus on the event itself and the range of contingencies and possibilities that existed that don't lead inevitably teleologically to the Holocaust. I think we succeeded to a large extent in doing that without distorting our discussion so much that we pretend that we don't know what's going to happen. In fact, a couple of the articles are very overt on the scene setting or stage setting motif. But I do think that was a self-conscious goal of ourselves in constructing the conference and the volume that came after. Let's see if we can confine chronologically for the most part and thematically for the most part the focus to the war itself and its the years immediately preceding and following.
And let me add to that. That's a very good point. I'm glad you made it. That it's not just the Holocaust that could, obscure the events of World War I. It's also the establishment later of the State of Israel. Because, of course, one of the important events of World War I was the fact that, A, the British government issued the Balfour Declaration in 1917, supporting, promising British support for the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. And Zionism was energized by that. And it's very easy, to read a straight line, from that to the establishment of Israel, when, of course, there was no straight line from that event to the establishment of the State of Israel. But also, a lot of people have seen World War I, as I've already alluded to this cradle of national identity. So the Jews become Jewish nationalists as well, right? They embrace Zionism, but they don't all embrace Zionism in the interwar period.
Or the same type of Zionism.
You can't read history backwards. or a type of Zionism, right? Jewish nationalism, that is the notion that the Jews were a nation entitled to certain recognition as a national entity, certainly did become more popular at the end of World War I and into the interwar period. But of course, not all Jews subscribe to it. And in fact, some of the articles in our volume, like the one on Salonika, shows intense clashes between Jews who embraced a Zionist perspective and Jews who did not embrace a Zionist perspective during the war and what that meant for their other loyalties at that moment. So we try to be careful about not reading history backwards, not just about the Holocaust, but also about the ultimate establishment of the State of Israel.
And finally, or perhaps not finally, but I would add that Marcia just enumerated, patriotism, anti-Semitism, etc. They take on a greater perspective. One gains a greater perspective when one views some of these themes transnationally, or as it were, globally. While these themes are very much present and prominent in local or national histories of Jews in World War I, when we have a comparative perspective, we can really see them in a very pronounced and nuanced way. I think that's one of the great advantages that the volume affords.
That's actually a nice segue into, I think, discussing a couple of these motifs, these themes that you, I think, very effectively organize the book sort of loosely around. One of them is Jewish inclusion versus exclusion, which we've touched on a bit, and I think we could maybe discuss a bit further. I wonder if you could explain to us, perhaps with a few examples, how that theme fits into the essays that are in this collection, and how it informs our understanding of the Jewish experience of the First World War.
Ooh, that's a big question. but it's a good one. It's a very important one. In many cases, Jews, at least at first, at the beginning of the war, felt included in the body politic, included in the nation at arms, right? It was a patriotic war, and the Jews were going to do their share, you know, their share. They were going to fight shoulder to shoulder with their comrades, and anti-Semitism would decline, they assumed, because obviously everyone would see how loyal and patriotic the Jews were, and they were dying for their fatherland, they were giving their money to support the war effort and their sons to support the war effort. And that certainly was true in Western Europe, in England, in France, in Germany, and even in Austria-Hungary, and the United States as well, although the United States enters the war later and it's a complicated situation there. But of course, that begins to unravel, as the war proceeds, especially in the Central Powers, in Germany and Austria-Hungary, but even in France or England. On the other hand, it's all very complicated. One of the nice things about this issue of inclusion, and the exclusion comes, obviously with the anti-Semitism, but with the on the inclusion side of things, is how it's different in different places and in interesting ways. For example, there's a wonderful article in our volume about France, and it relates to different episodes in France in which Jewish behavior was used as an example of Republican virtue, right? That is, by the general propagandists for the war. And that's really interesting, right? In one case, a rabbi who was a chaplain in the French army was killed at the beginning of the war while helping a Catholic soldier say his last rites.
Mm.
Wow, this was this fabulous example. And it wasn't just the Jews who used this rabbi to show how loyal they were. He was used by French propaganda as well. And that's really interesting. And then there was the second example in her article is about a young boy from Alsace who was so loyal to France. Alsace was then part of Germany. But this young man was so loyal to France because Alsace had been part of France for several centuries before 1870. He was so loyal to France that he deserted the German army and went to fight for France, but he was found by the Germans and executed for desertion. Well, the French used this as a wonderful example of the loyalty of people to France. They didn't use it as an example of Jewish loyalty, but of just loyalty of the Alsatians to France. Anyway, so that's a wonderful set of examples of Jewish inclusion. But it's more complicated. I'll let John talk about some.
I'll just add that the cover of the volume has an extraordinary picture, which is a a postcard from 1914 depicting this scene of the Jewish chaplain who is himself about to, or on the verge of death, but he is administering the last rites and holding a crucifix. This is a rabbi holding a crucifix before a dying Catholic soldier. And there's a bright, almost divine sunlight that is illuminating the scene. And it's very, very dramatic. So I think that... Yes, go ahead, Rob.
I was going to say that's a wonderful example of the inclusion of the Jews, but it was always more complicated. There was always complications about Jewish inclusion, not just because of the rise of anti-Semitism, but you know, certainly in Russia, you know, the Jews were ambivalent about their participation in the war effort. And in even in the United States, before America entered the war, a lot of Jews were ambivalent because Russia was the great enemy. And why should they fight on the same if America were to go to war with England and France, which is what most Americans supported, if they supported war at all? How could they fight with the allies of Russia when Russia was the great enemy?
Right.
On the other hand, the Jews of Austria-Hungary and Germany had a much easier time because the war was against Russia. And in, you know, Austria-Hungary in particular, the Jews, the main enemy in the first 2 years of the war was Russia. They didn't fight on the Western Front. They fought against Russia in the first 2 years of the war and then against Italy in the second 2 years of the war. And the Eastern Front, the Russian Front, was against Russia. Well, Russia was this great enemy of the Jews, the land of pogroms, the land of discrimination. So they were fighting. They could assert their Austrian patriotism at the same time as they were doing a Jewish cause and liberating the Jews, not just of Galicia, which the Russian army had occupied at the beginning of the war, but of all of Russian Poland and bringing, you know, sweetness and light and freedom and so forth to these Jews. But on the other hand, you've got the situation in the Ottoman Empire, which is much more complicated, right? The Jews had been loyal Ottomanists, but then the Ottoman army discriminated against Jews by putting, and also Christians, by putting them in labor battalions instead of in combat units. And the Jews were really mortified and hurt by that. So how do they fight in their, you know, and how do they fight for this country? I think one of the things that the volume does is it shows that it's always complicated. It wasn't just patriotism versus anti-Semitism. It was always complicated.
And one further example on the inclusion side that I think is worth mentioning is a terrific article by a young scholar named Jessica Cooperman, who looks at the efforts on the part of the War Department, the U.S. War Department, and General Pershing to create a chaplaincy social services for soldiers and for their morale fighting in the war or preparing to fight in the war. And they decide that in doing so, they're going to chiefly employ the YMCA, which, of course, was a missionizing Christian, Protestant Christian organization. And both... Catholics, who comprise about a third of the U.S. fighting force, and Jews, who were a much smaller percentage but still considerable, and Jewish organizations and Catholic organizations protested and eventually succeeded in having a Jewish and Catholic representation, a kind of a tri-faith chaplaincy. Instituted in the military beyond what had existed in the U.S. military ever before. And in the aftermath of the war, part of these efforts partly resulted in the creation of the USO, which was a non-denominational or multi-denominational service directed at helping and benefiting soldiers. American soldiers. So there's an interesting example of pluralism at work in the American context that was catalyzed by the conscription effort and the mobilization effort of World War I.
Right. That Kupferman article, Jessica Kupferman article, is really wonderful for all the reasons Jonathan just said, but also because she points out that this notion of inclusion of the Jews in a tri-faith America, which most scholars have assumed happened during World War II, mm-hmm. you know, Protestant, Catholic, Jew, we're all together, we're all Americans, you know, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. That happened in World War II, but she shows how it was already beginning in World War I, and the Jews felt really confident. The Jewish Welfare Board is the organization that the Jews themselves formed and to sort of cater to the needs of Jewish soldiers. And the Catholics had a similar organization. The Knights of Columbus organized it and so on. But, so the Jews were already in this period sort of asserting their right to be an equal religious group, even though they're a tiny religious group, right? I mean, what percentage of all Americans were Jewish in this period or in any period, right? Maybe it was 2% or something like that. But they, you know, if they're going to fight for America, they deserve the same religious services as others. And the American army ultimately recognized it. Initially, they were callous to the needs of Catholics, and not callous, but indifferent to the needs of Catholics and Jews. But then they realized, no, we need to attend to this. Wonderful. Article.
And that connects to another major theme that I think is present throughout the volume, which is sort of Jewish institutional life and the ways in which the creation of a number of organizations, both American but also sort of global and transnational, fought for different elements of Jewish rights. I wonder if you could expand on how these developments fit into the volume and also into the history of World War I and the Jews.
Jonathan, why don't you go first? I mean, I can go first too. But
on the spot.
Well, I'll just say briefly that the war called or mobilized Jews in different countries to respond institutionally and organizationally. First of all, organizations were established that were in essence patriotic organizations to organize or facilitate or inspire patriotism and participation of Jews in a given country. This fits in with what we were really just talking about. The war was an opportunity to demonstrate that Jews were loyal and willing to fight. I'm just going to spend a moment talking about that in a broader context. Going back to the 18th century, that had always been a central question as to whether Jews could be citizens. Those who were hostile to Jewish integration into European societies, as the idea of citizenship was starting to emerge, insisted that Jews were physically and morally and religiously ill-equipped to be soldiers and to make the kinds of sacrifices that were necessary for membership. And so while there had been certainly any number of opportunities in the 19th century to demonstrate otherwise, I think World War I really was the first sort of broad and universal, almost universal expression of that opportunity. And Jews, although there certainly were pacifists and opponents and those who didn't want to fight, among Jews, like among every other group, institutionally and in terms of representation, it was important to show this this devotion of loyalty. So there were Jewish organizations that emerged for that purpose. And there were also Jewish organizations that emerged for the purpose of asserting patriotism while also helping Jews suffering from the conflict elsewhere in the world. The principal example of that, but it's not the only example, is the Jewish Joint Distribution Committee that was established in 1914, particularly initially by American Jews in order to aid Jews suffering in Palestine. Now, Palestine was a place where the Jewish community was extremely poor. Also, the war had isolated that community from traditional sources of charity and assistance that had existed for centuries. And so the Joint, as it came to be known, sought to break through that isolation. And although there were many frustrations involved, it did succeed to a high degree in doing so. And there are other examples of that type, of course. In the American context, one might even say that World War I afforded American Jewry the opportunity to really assert itself globally. That partly had to do with America's neutrality until 1917, so that it had the opportunity to, Jews and American Jews had the opportunity to insert themselves elsewhere without appearing as a combatant. But it was also a kind of assertion of the way that the American Jewish community had matured and was ready to assert a kind of institutional and philanthropic leadership that hadn't really done so before. So I guess that's a beginning to answer a complicated question.
Right. And let me add to that, that the suffering of Jews was extreme. Palestine was an especially egregious case of it. There was starvation because of a locust epidemic in 1915. One of the articles in our volume deals with the plight of women in the Palestinian, in Palestine, Jewish women, mostly Sephardi Jewish women in Palestine in during World War One, and how they cope with their terrible situation. But it wasn't just Palestine, it was also Eastern Europe. A lot of Jews suffered horrifically during World War I. For example, the Russian army actually deported lots of Russian Jews to the Russian East, just because they were afraid they were spies for Germany and Austria, and they want, because they spoke Yiddish and, you know, whatever, I don't know. And so there was a great need to help those suffering. I mean, we were talking about huge numbers, not all Jews, but huge numbers were deported east. Also, there was the problem of refugee flight. That is, people in Galicia, which was, well, it was traditionally part of Poland, but it was part of Austria-Hungary, it was part of the Austrian Empire from the end of the 18th century. But the Russian army occupied it in World War I. The Jews were panic-stricken that the Russians would do terrible things to them. And so about 400,000 Jews from Galicia, and there were about 900,000 Jews. So almost half of the Jews of Galicia fled, and they went to Vienna, they went to Bohemian Moravia, they went to Hungary, they went all sorts of places. And Jews had to mobilize to help these people. The state helped them. The Russian state did not help them, but Austria did. I mean, it had, gave money to its refugees and so forth. It built refugee camps, it gave money. But it was fighting a war. It didn't have the resources to fully help them. And it wasn't just Jewish refugees. There were also non-Jewish refugees. And they relied on Jewish communities to step in and help. And sometimes that was done with great positive feeling and sometimes with less positive feeling. For example, one of the articles in the volume deals with Hungarian Jews, an article by Rebecca Klein-Pesheva. And, you know, they were eager to have the refugees, the Jewish refugees that came to Hungary, go to Austria because the Austrian government was paying for them, but the Hungarian government wasn't. Mm. So, you know, it was a little complicated. But the point is only that the Jews had to mobilize to help Jews in distress, whether it was in Palestine or in Eastern Europe or in Central Europe. And Jews in Western Europe didn't really have to do that, but Jews in Central and Eastern Europe did. And that, you know, led to a greater institutional Jewish presence. Like the Joint, you know, played an enormous role all over Eastern Europe and the Middle East in helping Jewish communities, not just during World War I, but ever since. And Jews actually took it upon themselves to not only help Jews financially with charitable efforts, but also to lobby governments to do something on behalf of Jews. And so after World War I, at the Versailles Peace Conference, there were all sorts of Jewish organizations that try to lobby with the powers, the you know, America and England and France, to work for Jewish rights in Poland and all over Eastern Europe and in Palestine, right? So the, you know, they were, and they were not fully successful, but they were partially successful. And American Jews played an important role, but not the only role in that. But Jews, my point really, and the point in the book is that Jews begin to be players in this kind of international politics when it comes to Jewish rights, and not just the rights of Jews as citizens. Jews have long lobbied for Jewish citizenship rights, starting in the late 19th century, but also for Jewish national rights. So, for example, Jews lobbied at Versailles to have Jewish national rights for the Jews of Poland. They didn't succeed. They only succeeded in getting some special rights, like Poland pledged not to hold elections on a Saturday, which would have disenfranchised 10% of the Polish population if they
right.
did. And so forth. But so Jews were kind of players on the international scene, not just in the charitable side, but also on the political side.
I think it's so fascinating that on the one hand, Jews are asserting their patriotism and loyalty. We're as German as any German. We're as French as any Frenchman. But on the other hand, they're also asserting their international and transnational right. role in solidarity with Jews around the world. That had always been a fear, that Jews would be accused of being a nation within a nation, that they would be accused of being more loyal to co-religionists in other places than they were to their fellow citizens. And of course, those tensions very much existed during World War I. But we also see a willingness of many Jews to try to have both, try to have their cake and eat it too. Of course, it helped if they could assert an international role that was consistent with national patriotism. But often it was more complicated than that. So so that's another irony that we see emerging in very much highlighted by the conflict.
Right. Although they sometimes fight with each other, right? British
That's true.
Jews, you know, there were different factions within British Jewry and different factions within American Jewry, right? That, you know, supporting a more national approach, you know, an international, Jewish cause and others that were more nervous about that. So a lot of things are put into sharp relief by the war and the need to do something for suffering Jews.
I just add there's a really brilliant chapter by David Engel at NYU
yes.
in the book. And he argues somewhat a little bit discordant with what we've just been saying, discordantly with what we've just been saying. It's hard to summarize his very nuanced argument briefly, but essentially, he wants to make the case that World War I was a decisive turning point in Jewish history. And a major part of that is his argument that whereas individual wealthy Jews like Jacob Schiff or the Rothschilds in the era preceding the war could sometimes effectively intervene on behalf of foreign Jewries to protect them, say in Russia against the Tsars or elsewhere, the sheer expense and economic transformation that the war entailed essentially made it impossible for any individual Jew or even small group of wealthy Jews to have that kind of financial and even diplomatic power. And so it resulted in the need to create institutions and organizations and work hand in hand with the diplomatic corps and through institutional channels in the U.S. government or in other governments to advance a Jewish agenda in terms of foreign policy. And his point, if I understand it correctly, is really that in many ways this was a less efficacious or could be a less effective mechanism than what had existed before with the individual sort of powerful wealthy lobbyist acting on behalf of the Jew. So whereas the reputation of Jews, the sort of stereotype surrounding Jews in many ways in the aftermath of World War I following the Balfour Declaration and other seeming diplomatic achievements by Jews, was that Jews were really powerful and that World War I proved their clout on the international stage. What Engel is saying, I think, is that that was very deceptive. And in reality, the New World was so large, in a sense, in terms of bureaucracy, states, budgets, that Jews were actually weakened in the aftermath of the war. Does that sound about right, Marcia?
That does. I mean, and he is slightly pessimistic. You're right.
Yes. Yeah,
more than slightly. He's very pessimistic. But he also points out that in the aftermath of the war, you no longer have these large empires. So that
right.
the addresses which Jews had to address, I mean, there were many countries, right? There were all these new countries in Eastern Europe, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Romania, etc. Well, Romania had existed, but it was bigger. They're all, instead of just the Habsburg monarchy, the Russian Empire, you know, you have all these small states, and many of which are anti-Semitic, not all, but many of which are anti-Semitic. But you also have the new states of the Middle East. You no longer have the Ottoman Empire. You have Iraq and Syria, Lebanon, the British Mandate for Palestine, and so on and so forth. And so that individual Jews can no longer just meet with the head of the Russia or the head of Austria-Hungary, right? Everything becomes more diffuse and therefore harder, just on that simple level.
Exactly.
Than it had been. So it's a really, you know, everything is a complicated situation and becomes more difficult. On the one hand, you do have these new organizations that are able to make a difference, like the Joint, which is helping all of the national organizations. So, for example, you know, in Austria, an Austrian organization helped refugees, but they got most of their money from the Joint. So the Jewish world is really very interconnected, and the Joint is really funding a lot of effort, and it continued to do so. It still does so, but it continued to do so in the aftermath of the war and into World War II.
Well, and I think what the book does such an incredible job demonstrating is the plurality of Jewish experiences during and after the war, but at the same time, as you both have mentioned, the sort of new forms of interconnectedness that are emerging, these new transnational ties that really, you know, change, or I guess are factors that shape the Jewish experience throughout the 20th century to today.
Right. And they're doing it more publicly, too. I mean, I'm just, as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, at the Congress of whatever city that worked on the creation of Romania and Serbia and Bulgaria in 1878, German Jews and French Jews and British Jews lobbied for Jewish rights in those new countries. But they did so behind the scenes. Mm. Right. And they did so through these personal ties of wealthy Jews and so forth to heads of state. So, for example, Germany, too, lobbied for, Bleichroeder, who was a wealthy banker in Germany. He lobbied Bismarck to fight for Jewish rights in the new Romania and so forth. But in the aftermath of World War I at Versailles, it's a much more public and much more organizational thing. It's not rich guys doing the lobbying anymore. It's Jewish organizations, sometimes ad hoc, sometimes more permanent, that are lobbying, and they're doing so in a public manner. And so they're asserting Jewish international ties for all to see, which is very interesting.
I know I've already taken up a lot of your time, and this has been a fascinating discussion. But before I let you both go, I want to give you a chance to talk about the upcoming event that this book is affiliated with. I know we have many listeners in and around New York City, and I wonder if maybe you want to plug it.
Yes, well, we're very excited. We would thank you for that, for that opportunity. We appreciate it. We're having an event at the Center for Jewish History, which I mentioned at the beginning, which is a wonderful facility on 16th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues in Manhattan. It's going to be on Sunday, November 11th at, I think, 2 o'clock, 2 p.m. in the afternoon.
So not at the 11th hour of the 11th.
Right.
Day of the 11th month, which is when World War I, the armistice was signed. But it is the centennial of the end of World War I.
We were able to choose that date, and it was it worked out beautifully that we could have that date for this event. And we'll be discussing the book. We'll have a panel of scholars discussing the book and entertaining questions from the audience. We're going to have a reception that will be sponsored by Bergan Books, which published the volume. And I'm also very pleased to announce for the first time on national radio or podcast that that Bergan, I think, is so pleased with the volume, which has been out for a year now, that they're going to issue a paperback edition. And I think it might be available for sale at that event. I would expect so. So we invite everybody who's in the vicinity to come, and we'd love to meet you and discuss this volume with you and all of the issues that it raises, as we've begun to do today.
Yeah, sure. I'm sure we'll have many listeners that will be able to come by. I think it sounds like a very exciting and thought-provoking event. I wish I could come myself.
We wish you could be there. You ask good questions.
Thanks. You two are very easy guests. So much to say. Well, John and Marcia, this has been fantastic. I'm so glad that we were able to make this work and to have you come on the show. It was a really excellent discussion. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
Take care.